This talk will not compare to quantum teleportation. That's a very modest result that I wanted to report. Something I noticed about seven days ago, so it's quite new, but modest. But I hope it will be of some interest. Hanging around here, one sees symmetric information and complete measurements popping up from time to time. It's hard not to think about them, and so that's what I was doing last week, thinking about them. And I realized, by the way, that there are actually experts on that subject here, and I'm not one of them, here in this very room. Not to mention Marcus Appleby, who's out of town at the moment. So here's the outline of the talk. First of all, introduction to Seeks, symmetric information and complete measurements. Then a particular measurement for 3 qubits. And then I'll talk a little bit about other composite systems. Symmetric information and complete POVM. It's a special kind of measurement. It's possible to express a quantum state via probabilities it specifies for a measurement. Yes, Robin.
Does anybody know a way to turn off the lights that are shining?
Oh, yes.
Without turning us down there enough that. I'll try these until we find them.
Not good.
That's good.
Okay. Instead of writing down a quantum state by giving a density matrix, we can write down a quantum state by giving a set of probabilities of outcomes of measurements. And this is, in fact, central to the quantum Bayesian framework and other frameworks as well. The expression in terms of probabilities is particularly simple if we're talking about the outcomes of a very symmetric measurement or a class of measurements. A complete set of mutually unbiased measurements has a nice symmetry. That would be a bunch of orthogonal measurements such that each vector in one of the bases, in any of the bases, has an equal magnitude inner product with all of the vectors of any of the other bases. It's very nice and symmetric, but it's not likely that such complete sets exist in every dimension. Symmetric information, a complete measurement, is a single measurement with in d dimensions has d squared outcomes, which is the minimum number that you would need to specify a quantum state completely. And it's quite possible that such a measurement exists for every dimension. And I'll start with talking about just a single qubit, where it's the one case where I can picture it, one of these measurements. So here's the Bloch sphere. And this is my attempt at drawing in PowerPoint a regular tetrahedron inscribed in the sphere. Hope you can see it that way. So the four corners here represent four tetrahedrally related points, and they constitute a seek for a single qubit. And one way to describe them is in terms of the Pauli operators. I'll use x, y, and z for the Pauli operators. And now let psi be the plus one eigenstate of x plus y plus z over root 3. So that's sort of, if these are x, y, and z axes like this, or x, y, and z, this is, we're thinking of a vector that's sort of sticking up like that in the Bloch sphere. So start with that, that's that point there. Take that point, and now rotate it around the z axis by 180 degrees, you get this point, which is another element. Or you take this and rotate it around the x axis by 180 degrees, you get this point. Or around the y axis, and you get this point. And so that generates your seek for a single qubit. So here are those states, your starting state, these three other states, and these are the projection operators, the pi's are the projection operators onto those states. If you divide each of those by 2, you get a POVM. They add up to the identity, they're positive operators, and they have this symmetry property. In d dimensions, we define a seek as a set of operators one over d times, one-dimensional rank one projection operators, they're d squared of them, and they make equal angles again. You can think of them as just a bunch of pure states, that d squared pure states in d dimensions that make equal angles. It's a not an orthogonal measure. Okay, so if you have a density matrix rho, you can, the probabilities of the outcomes of that measurement are pj given by this formula, so you have d squared of them. And then if you have the p's, you can get back to the density matrix by this formula. It's pretty simple. And again, the simplicity is because of the symmetry of the measurement. Okay, and here's a simple example for a single qubit. If you take psi itself, which is this state, and express it, you know, in this language, in terms of probabilities, the probabilities are 1/2, 1/6, 1/6, 1/6. The probability, if you make this, if you have this, if this is your state, then the probability of getting this outcome is 1/2. It's not 1 because it's not an orthogonal measurement. Okay. It has been fruitful in looking for these things in higher dimension to use the Weyl-Heisenberg symmetry, which is to say you start with some starting state, a fiducial vector, and then apply a whole bunch of operators to it to get the others in this set. In the case of qubits, those operators are just the Pauli operators. And in higher dimensions, just generalizations of the Pauli operators, general Pauli matrices. X, which is this shift, and then Z, which is this phase off, which multiplies each basis state by a different phase. And you take all possible powers of those, and that gives you d squared states. And what you hope to get, you hope to find, choose one of these, a starting state, so that those d squared states will make a seek. And people have been very successful with this. Here are some examples of fiducial vectors. Fiducial vectors for d equals 3 is very, very simple. You could almost guess that one. For d equals 4, it's hard to guess. This one came from a paper by these guys who really brought this notion of seeks to the attention of physicists. These vectors have been found analytically for a number of dimensions. And numerically for dimensions up to 67. So there's some reason to hope that they exist in all dimensions. Okay. Now, I just want to mention something from this paper by Chris and Rudiger this year. How to write down the Born rule in terms of a seek, because it has a certain elegance. So here's the thing I'd like to imagine. I'm going to do it by an example first, and then I'll write down the general formula. So suppose you have a qubit, say a spin 1/2 particle. It's in the up state here. We want to know what's the probability of measuring it up if we do the up versus down measurement. OK, we know the answer. The answer is 100% probability of being up. But here's a way of getting that answer in terms of the seek picture. And I've rotated the tetrahedron so that it has a point at the North Pole now. So we can describe the state by its probabilities, pj. Those are the probabilities of those four outcomes. And we can describe the measurement outcome here by probabilities. What's the probability of getting up if you start with one of these four states? Okay, that characterizes the measurement outcome. And now you can imagine a scenario where you start with this state, you perform this measurement, okay, actually do the seek measurement, you have four possible outcomes, and then you say, given one of these outcomes, what's the probability that that state would be measured as up? Okay, and so the rule for computing that is just this familiar rule for combining probabilities. The probability of up in that scenario is the probability of the zero state times the probability of up given that you get zero, and so on. You add all those things up. And here it is, it's 1/2 times 1, and so on, which adds up to 2/3. And the way to do it, but then what if you're not making this measurement? Suppose you're just using this measurement to describe this, and you're using this measurement to describe that, but you're actually just going to send this straight to there. So how do you modify the rule in order to get the right answer in that circumstance? And Chris and Rudiger showed that what you do is you take these probabilities, that is, these probabilities, and you modify them. You change them to different numbers. So this one half, and the way you do it in this cubic case is very simple. You take each of those probabilities, you multiply it by 3, and then subtract a half. Okay, so a half times 3 minus a half is 1. Okay, 6 times 3 minus a half is 0, and so on. And you replace those probabilities, that is these guys, with these modified numbers here. Then you add it up again, and now you get 1. Okay, there's a certain feel here that it feels a little bit like interference. Like there are these, it's kind of constructive interference, except that there's no phase here. It's all just in terms of probabilities. The general rule, for the general Born rule in terms of a seek, goes like this. So if you're taking the upper path, and you're actually, if you're performing that measurement, that symmetric measurement, this is the way you would compute the probability of some outcome alpha at the right-hand side. You just say, what's the probability of getting outcome j of the seek times the probability of alpha given j, sum that over j. But if you're not actually doing the seek, if you're just using it to represent states and measurements, then the rule is you take that p and you replace it with this thing, where d is the dimension of the space. That's a pretty simple formula. Again, simple because of the symmetry of the seek. So what you do here is any probability that's bigger than average, you make it even bigger. That's what this is doing. By average, I mean the average. So 1 over d squared would be the average. Probabilities have to add up to 1, and they're d squared of them. That would be the average probability, 1 over d squared. Any probability bigger than that gets enhanced here. Any probability smaller than that gets reduced, right? To him who has, more will be given. To him who has not, even though he has, will be taken away. Yes, Robin?
I just want to comment that, if, unless I'm wrong, the niceness of that doesn't actually come from the symmetry of the seek. It comes from it being a two design.
Oh!
For any two design.
Oh, that is true. Very good point. That's true. Okay, you're right. It's not the symmetry. It's
like
two design.
Months, for instance.
Which months would do that too. Yeah, that is true.
Well, it is a symmetry, just weaker symmetry.
But in a seek, I mean, symmetric.
Uh-huh.
Information like complete PLBN.
That has more symmetry.
The equality of the inner products. So you take any two designs.
Yeah.
But I mean, the being a two design implies some certain things. That's all I'm saying. Just not this much.
Oh, all right. So it's even more general. Okay, suppose you have composite systems. You want to consider composite systems. You write down a seek for them. Or you just want to use some sort of, you want to use measurements that can provide probabilities to represent quantum states. And I'm going to use the example of 3 qubits. You'll see shortly why I'm using the example of 3 qubits. Now, for 3 qubits, we could define a probability of a POVM just by taking tensor products of seek vectors. So we take, say, these 4 vectors of a seek for a single qubit, tensor them together, and that would be fine. We'd have 64 vectors here, which would be a POVM, but they would not be a seek. They wouldn't have equal angles between them. On the other hand, this does reflect the structure of the system we're talking about if we're really meaning 3 qubits. We can identify the 3 individual qubits. It would be kind of cool to have a seek that had this symmetry that these guys have. So these guys do not have the Weyl-Heisenberg symmetry, okay, in 8 dimensions, okay, where you're doing this shift. This, you know, shift mod 8. There's nothing mod 8 about this. It's all mod 2. So it'd be interesting if we could find a seat that had this symmetry instead of the Weyl-Heisenberg symmetry, then it's somehow reflecting the structure of the system that we're talking about, the fact that it really is three qubits.
Sorry, that's not already known?
Hmm?
We don't already know ones like that?
Do we already know one? We know of exactly one like that. Right. And it's coming up in a few slides.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, so Robin.
I guess another clarification. So am I right that the word symmetry has been used in, I think, three precisely different ways?
Oh, that's very likely.
So we use symmetry in symmetric informationally complete POEM that meant every pair of inner products is the same.
Yes.
And then Chris used it for a sort of a uniformity that a two design has. And then here, I think you mean the group theoretics.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so and these are not.
You're right. You're right. This is different. I mean, you could have, in principle, a symmetric informationally complete measurement, which doesn't have this group property, of group symmetry property, quite conceivably. It's just that the ones that have been found do have.
And this, the symmetry that you refer to here is a group symmetry that the first POVM has, right?
Yes,
it is not a seek.
That is correct. That is correct. This group symmetry is something that this thing, this POVM has it. This doesn't have the equal angles. So can you find something that has this group symmetry? Yeah, thanks for the clarification. I really do appreciate it. It has this group symmetry, but also has symmetry in the first sense, which is this equal angle sense. So if you can, if you base your probabilities on something like that, then presumably those probabilities will reflect the qubit structure, the fact that you actually have three qubits in a way, and not just a generic eight-dimensional system. Okay, and here's the good news, that for three qubits, yes, we can find something like that. Okay, and we now approach the high point of this talk. If you don't like this in the next couple of slides, the rest of the talk's not going to please you either. This is the best, this is as good as it gets. Okay, now here's the good news. For three qubits, yes, indeed, there is one. And it even uses the properties of the single qubit seeks. Okay, and before I show it to you, since I have to have a little bit of gratification delay here. I'm going to show you a few more facts about the single qubit seeks. I'm actually thinking of two single qubit seeks. So there's a tetrahedron that I tried to draw originally, and there's the opposite tetrahedron, okay, which has a corner where the faces were of the other one. So just a reflection of the first one. So I'm now calling phi plus the fiducial state for the original seek that I was drawing there, the plus one eigenstate of x plus y plus z over root 3. And then phi minus is just the opposite. It's the orthogonal state, diametrically opposite on the Bloch sphere. It's the negative one eigenstate of that same operator. So each of those defines generates a seek for a single qubit. And now, just here's some simple facts one can check about the inner products. This DJ could be either the X, Y, or Z Pauli operator, doesn't matter which one. If you take this, the inner product of this with that, you get 1 over root 3. It had to have magnitude 1 over root 3, that's what a seek is all about. It's this 1 over root, the square root of D plus 1. But the phase, and it turns out, happens to be plus 1. The phase of this one here, with phi minus, happens to be minus 1. Okay, minus 1 over root 3. It's also going to be interesting in the next slide to talk about this kind of matrix element, where you've applied one of the Pauli's to phi minus, and you take the inner product of phi plus. You get, if you choose the relative phase correctly between these things, which we'll do, you get this negative root 2/3, and then this is a cube root of unity. Okay, so now, those are the only facts you need in order to show that this thing here generates a seek for dimension 8. Okay, again, this is the high point. Okay, so here is, what is this? So you're just taking three copies of that phi plus, okay, and then three copies of the phi minus, okay, and then you superpose those with positive real amplitude A and amplitudes A and B, and as long as A squared plus B squared equals 1 for normalization, and as long as you make this choice, then this thing works. Okay, it generates a seek for 8 dimensions. Okay, it's got to be nearly a record for the simplest. Simplicity divided by the dimension. This may be the smallest. Or simplicity, I don't know. Okay, whatever. Simplicity time, I don't know. Okay. So here's the claim. The
complexity of any previous analytic seek result beyond D equals 2.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yes, right. So here's the claim that this thing really is equal to 1/3 as long as you've not just done the identity here. If you've done something non-trivial, it's going to be 1/3. Okay, and I'll take you through it, not too slowly, I'll go pretty fast, because it's just arithmetic, it's not that exciting, but it's kind of interesting to see how it works out. It's just nice that you can show it so quickly, too. So first of all, consider the case where only one of the d's is not the identity. Okay, then when you take the interproduct between this and this, only one of these guys has been changed, so the others are still sitting there, which means that this is still going to be orthogonal to the plus one over here, and this is going to be orthogonal to the minus one over here. I'm imagining this inner product. And so you only get an a squared times something or other and a b squared times something or other. And the something or others are just plus 1 over root 3 and minus 1 over root 3. That's the plus and minus from the previous slide. And so if you just choose a squared minus b squared equal to 1 over root 3, which is the choice we're making here, then this times this is equal to 1/3. By the way, the 1/3 is there because that's 1 over the square root of 9, and 9 is d plus 1 for an 8-dimensional space. Okay, so that works. You can also easily see that it's going to work if two of these things are not the identity, because then it's the same kind of argument, except you get two factors of the 1 over root 3, and then the minus sign goes away because you have two factors. And so you have 1, this had to be a 1, and this almost had to work, okay, for this case. And then the only one that's left is in all 3, and it's a little bit trickier there because you have this cross terms now. You don't have the orthogonality helping you out. But if you just work it through, you see that, I mean, there's no more freedom, unfortunately. There was a phase freedom here. We could have put in a phase here, but it wasn't necessary. This comes out to be 1/9. These guys, remember, basically the cube roots of unity, multiply them together, it's still cube roots of unity. The real part of that is going to be either 1 or minus a half. And so you only have two possibilities. And they both happen to add up to something that's good. 1/9 plus 2/9 is 3/9, which is 1/3. 1/9 minus 4/9 is -3/9, which also has magnitude 1. So it works. So there's the proof that it works. So that's the good news. You can probably see where this is going. This is the okay news. Okay, it's not bad, it's okay. A very similar seek had been found before, and this is the one I was referring to, Daniel, but Hagar in 1998 came up with one. And at first I thought it was really quite different from this one based on the phi plus and phi minus. But then if you put them both in the standard basis, and I thank OSA for giving me this particular simple version of Hagar's construction. You can take the fiducial vector to be this. In the standard basis, Hagar's looks like this, and the one I just showed you looks like this. And you can see that there's a certain resemblance. Q here is just 1 plus I over root 2. There's a difference. In fact, you can see that these are locally inequivalent. You can't just take one of these states and locally rotate. You can see that by looking, for example, at the three tangle of the three qubits. How entangled are they in a kind of three-way sense? And this one's more entangled. It's kind of, is it more entangled in that sense than this one is? So they're not locally equivalent, but they do generate in the big eight-dimensional space, they do generate seeks which are globally the same. Globally, unitarily equivalent, rather. So you can rotate one of them in the eight-dimensional space into the other. And here is the rotation that will do that. These are Pauli X operators, and then control not, where one controls three, and two, one controls two, and three controls one, and so on. You do that sequence of operations, you can take this guy into that guy. So it's not even all that new, but it has a certain symmetry among the qubits that you don't see in that state there. Okay, and now we get to the bad news, which is three qubits is a special case. This theorem was proved not so long ago for n qubits. This is just for qubits. If there is a seek with states of this form, which is exactly the form that I've been talking about, then the number of qubits must be 1 or 3. Okay, and those are two cases that we've covered. And so as far as qubits are concerned, we've found them all, basically. Or there may be some others for dimension 8. This still leaves open the possibility of other composite seeks, for example, 3 by 3 dimensions or 2 by 2 by 3, as long as it's not all qubits, 2 by 2 by 4 even, 2 by 19, whatever. Those are still open, but yes, Robin. I can go back.
Well, you don't have to. Your solution and Hogarth's solution are related by a Clifford.
Yes, indeed.
And since the symmetry group is the Pauli group,
yes,
wouldn't any Clifford acting on either of your solutions give another seek?
So oh, yes, indeed.
Yours and Hogarth's are both elements of an entire Clifford.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sure. Yes. I'd like you to ask how many different ones are there and so on. But anyway, yes, that's true. So a whole bunch of them, which will be, many of them will be locally inequivalent, I guess, but globally equivalent, unitarily. That is exactly right. Okay. So, yes, we still have the possibility of 3 by 3, 2 by 2 by 4, and so on. These haven't been ruled out. But the above construction, the simple, to taking three copies, that sort of thing, really does seem kind of special for three qubits. Unfortunately, I was much more excited about this last week. Now I'm a little bit, I've tried a bit with 3 by 3 and with no success. What are we using here? There are two orthogonal fiducial vectors for d equals 2. That's also true for d equals 3, maybe true for many others. But, and we use both of those, the phi plus and the phi minus. But something that's really interesting, that word that we depended on for that construction, is that this ratio, which had to be just a pure phase factor, was the very same phase factor regardless of j. It was always negative 1. That's not the case for dimension 3. You can't, that doesn't work for dimension 3. You can take two orthogonal starting vectors, but these guys will both be independent of J. That means you have a whole lot more constraints that have to be satisfied, way more than you can possibly satisfy. Yes, Robin?
Sorry to interrupt again.
Oh, it's great that you're interrupted.
So for D equals 3, there's actually a continuum.
It's a continuum.
So this is not true for any orthogonal fiducials?
Unless I've made a mistake somewhere. I have checked that whole continuum, and which I know this is why I was thinking 3 by 3 is going to be great. There are an infinite number of choices.
Oh yeah,
that's not enough. another thing, another thing that was sort of crucial in that little construction to make it work is that 2 plus 1 squared is the same as 2 cubed plus 1. That is, this d plus 1, which appeared in the qubit case, which was important for the cubic case, is related to the 8 plus 1 when you have 3 qubits. And that won't work for any other dimensions. You take any dimension, some other dimension, and then you take any third dimension, if you want a third object. And this is never going to be true, unless all the d's are equal to 2. And you definitely need a third object, because this is not going to be true either. So there's some things that we use that just aren't going to pop up again in other cases. So now I'm back to, well, suppose we do have 3 qubits, okay? I suppose that what you really care about are 3 particular qubits. Okay, then this is available. This seek is available to you. And what can you do with it? So here's the state description. You just take your density matrix, slap on the seek vectors, and get these probabilities. They add up to 1. J, K, and L each take 4 values corresponding to the identity and 3 Pauli operators. And also, the J is associated with the first qubit, the K is associated with the second qubit, the L is associated with the third. So for example, you can do things like this. If you want to find what's the purity of the AB system, subsystem, there's a formula for that, just in terms of PJK, where you've summed over L. So it's like tracing over the third qubit. So you can do this. By the way, this is the formula, this is not a subsystem, it's the whole system, and this is quite general. This is always d times d plus 1. You get rid of system C, you get this. Get rid of system B, you get that. So you can at least talk about the individual subsystems very easily, starting with these probabilities because of the structure. And I have actually worked out the GHZ state, GSS state. What does it look like in this representation? Here's what it looks like. And I think this has to be one of the best diagrams ever made. there are some of these blocks in there that represent the probability 596, but you don't know where they are. You can't see them all, but you can kind of guess. So this is the probability of getting the fiducial vector, okay, the one that I showed here, A, B plus B plus 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 B, B minus B minus B minus. If you start with this state, okay, that probability is small. But then if you do some Paulis, like do the Pauli Z on one of them, now the probability is bigger. And so on. So, and then you can take sum these probabilities over one of the dimensions, and you get a probability distribution that completely describes 2 of the qubits, or you can sum over the other and get probability distribution that describes the 1 qubit. In this case, it's the completely mixed state. Okay. But it does seem that such composite seeks may be rare. Certainly no other things for n qubits, unless n is 3. So let's go back to this question. So consider, again, a POVM made from a product of 2 seeks. And now, so I'm talking about a composite system that's made out of 2 things. And I'm actually, okay, so this is a seek, these guys make a seek, these guys make a seek. Together, they don't make a seek for the dA times dB dimensional space. Here's how you describe a state by these probabilities. Okay, it's a fine way of using probabilities to represent a state. I thought I would show you what the Born rule looks like if you use one of these. Okay. And if you do it in a way that respects the structure, this is what I'm looking for. So a Born rule and seeks that respect the structure of this, the tensor product structure somehow, the fact that you have 2 subsystems. So here's a kind of diagram, sort of like the Chris's and Rudiger's diagram. But now you have 2 systems. I've drawn them like as qubits, but they're just any old systems. And now you're doing 2 seeks, okay? One for one of them, one for the other. Okay, so you have this product seek. And now you're asking, what's the probability of a certain outcome? It could be any outcome over here that you're measuring. It doesn't have to be a product outcome or anything. So there's this path where you actually perform that measurement, and then you say, what's the probability of that? And there's this path, which is where you've described this in terms of that measurement, and you've described this in terms of that measurement. Here's the description. But you want to know, what's the probability of going directly from here to this outcome? Well, here's the answer. Here's how it comes out. In terms of these subsystems, that looks maybe a little less pretty than the other way of doing it. But it's sort of intriguing because you can get that formula in the following way, which is reminiscent of what Chris and Rudiger did. So,
first, here, Bill, before you go there, the measurement at the end?
Yes.
Can that be an arbitrary measurement?
It's an arbitrary
or is that the product measurement?
It's an arbitrary measurement, not a product measurement. I sort of drew it as a product, but it can be an arbitrary measurement.
Okay, so there are two indices in one side of the condition, but not necessarily two indices. The alpha is not a two index.
The alpha is just labeling the measurement. It could be a POV, and it doesn't have to be orthogonal.
Okay.
Okay, so this looks kind of like a mess, but now I'm trying to sort of follow the kind of thing that Chris and Rudiger were doing. So you start with this, which is the correct way of figuring out the probability is you take the upper path, where you actually perform the POV, which is not a C. Okay. And now, in order to get the correct answer, what you do is this. First of all, no one can stop you from subtracting the product PJA PKB. So this is, you know, particle A, particle B, and then adding it back in again, right? And that's perfectly okay. So this is another way of getting the probability for the upper path. And then let's just define that to be this correlation matrix, the actual probability PJK minus the product of those. These are just the marginal probabilities, PJ and PK. Call that the correlation matrix, C. And so you have this formula. And now, to get the Born-Little formula, what you do is you do exactly what Chris and Rudiger did for each individual particle. You make this substitution, and as the big probabilities get bigger, the small probabilities get smaller in this particular way. Same for B. And then, in addition, you make the correlations bigger. Okay, so when you're not making that measurement, if you're just going bypassing the measurement, then you get the same kind of changes that we had before that are in Chris and Rudiger's paper, and you also get that the correlations are enhanced, if you will. Okay, and then that gives you the correct formula. Okay, let's see. So here it is. I just said that big probabilities get bigger and the correlations get larger. Okay, so conclusions so far. I have another little story to tell, but conclusions so far go like this. There exists a seek for three qubits with the Pauli-Pauli-Pauli symmetry, okay, as opposed to the Biot-Heisenberg in dimension 8 symmetry. And you can see that it works by looking at the properties of the seeks for the individual qubits, which is a cool thing, which is what initially got me excited, but I see now that it's a very special case. It's probably not going to work for many other cases, if any others. It's interesting to ask whether there's any other example, in fact, of a composite seek. We know it won't work for any number of qubits. But products of seeks may be a good way of describing systems. Where you care about the composition. So if you want to describe something in terms of the outcomes of a single measurement, there's something to be said for that kind of measurement, product of seeks, which is not a seek itself. Okay, so now I think I can take a few more minutes. I want to shift gears just a little bit because I wanted to share with you, so where did that form come from? Why did I even think of that form of a, you know, phi plus, phi plus, phi plus, superposed with phi minus, phi minus, phi minus? It came from some other work that I had done a couple of years ago. So I'm just going to mention that really quickly. It's another way in which three qubits seem to be special. Rotationally invariant states in discrete phase space. Okay, so let me just say a few words about that. It'll take a few slides, not many. Okay, so here is a discrete phase space for a single qubit. This axis is associated with, I'm thinking of it as spin one half particle, spin up and spin down. This axis is spin right and spin left. And we also associate numbers with those axes. And the numbers are elements of the two-element field with the usual arithmetic, so arithmetic mod 2. Each point in phase space can be associated with a Pauli operator, okay, given by the x operator to the q and the z operator to the p. And then every, there are three sets of parallel lines here. That's a set of parallel lines. That's a set of parallel lines. And then these guys are also parallel lines. And each of them can be associated with a particular orthogonal basis in the Hilbert space. It's the basis that's invariant under the Pauli operators associated with the ray that defines that set of parallel lines. So there's a basis for this, a basis for this, and a basis for this. And those are guaranteed to be mutually unbiased. So you have these mutually unbiased bases associated with the sets of parallel lines in the phase space. Then you can define a Wigner function just so that you just define it so that when you sum over the Wigner function are these numbers here, a real number assigned to each point in phase space, and it represents a quantum state. And the deal is that when you sum the Wigner function over a line, you get the probability of that outcome of that particular orthogonal measurement. So for the up state, the probability of up is 1, the probability of down is 0, the probability of right is a half, the probability of left is a half. The probability of the positive y direction is 1 half, the probability of negative y direction is 1 half. Here is the phi minus state that we used before as a Wigner function. You see that it can get negative. So that's a Wigner function for a single qubit. Here's phase space for two qubits. The only difference is that now instead of the two-element field, you have the four-element field. Here's the arithmetic of the four-element field. There are lines and parallel lines and so on, and the whole structure works again, and you have five different mutually unbiased bases associated with five different sets of parallel lines. And you can talk about, you can associate a Pauli operator with each point in the phase space. And you can talk about Wigner functions of definite states. So here's the up-up state. Here's the up-right state. What do they look like in phase space? Okay, so what Daniel Sussman and I, Daniel's a student of mine, were looking at, we were wondering if there are any, in discrete phase space, if there's any analog of a coherent state in the regular phase space. So in regular continuous phase space, coherent state is this Gaussian thing. And we're thinking of it centered at the origin of phase space. It has a positive Wigner function, and it's rotationally invariant. Is there anything like that in the discrete case? So to define that, we just talked about, you had to define rotation. That's fine. You can define circles in kind of the usual way, except it can't just be q squared plus p squared equals a constant. It has to be a different quadratic thing, just to make sure that that there won't be, the only way to make this thing zero is to have both q and p be equal to zero. You can't have it be zero out here. So you just choose your quadratic polynomial that have that property. And you say that defines a set of circles. And then you can talk about linear transformations that preserve circles, and they call those rotations, linear transformations on the phase space. You can associate a unitary operator with each one of those with such a rotation. And then the eigenstates of the unitary operator are states that whose Wigner functions are constant on circles. So they're rotationally invariant. And so you start to see that you can imagine something that's kind of like a coherent state in the continuous case. So there's the question. Do there exist rotationally invariant states with a positive Wigner function, like a coherent state in the continuous? And, well, we don't have the complete answer for that question, but here's what we did. We tried this for two qubits, or one qubit, two qubits, three qubits, four qubits, up to seven qubits to look for these states. And we found them only for the case of one qubit and three qubits. Okay, so in the case we've tried, here's a picture of the Wigner function for the three qubit case. This is a circle. And what you see here are basically three circles where the Wigner function is the same on all three circles and so on. Okay, but what's kind of curious is, first of all, that there's another thing special about three qubits. You have this rotationally invariant positive Wigner function. Another thing that's curious is that the actual state that has that Wigner function looks a heck of a lot like this fiducial state I showed you a few slides ago. If you have a really good memory, you'll notice it's not exactly the same. It was 1 over root 3 before, and now it's 1 over root 3. Okay. And so there's some curious thing going on there. I don't understand it at all. Don't claim to understand it. And so I guess the conclusion is, that's the last slide. The conclusion of all of this is, yes, for three qubits, you can make one of these cool composite seeks. But that's the only example we know. And even that it comes from the seeks for the individual qubits. That's the only example we know like that. And we know that it can't work for n qubits, if we insist on the Pauli symmetry for each qubit. Maybe there's some other crazy symmetry that somehow respects the structure, the composite structure. Maybe it has some swaps in it or something. I don't know. But that's where the matter stands. And that's it. Thanks for listening. Yes, Daniel.
So, do you know what the symmetry group of your sec is?
The
sec that you showed.
What's the symmetry group?
Yeah. So instead of.
Oh, I see. I'm thinking of it as a.
Reference that.
Yeah. What's the thinking of it as like a polyhedron or something?
Yeah.
What's the that I don't know off the top of my head. That's a great question.
Plus, right?
I mean, it's got
it's going to be some perforates.
It's going to be what?
It's an equivalent group.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Which ones?
But which one? That is a good question. Exactly. Right. So which Clifford operations will leave you in the same seat?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do we know it's only Clifford?
I think I can prove that.
What's that?
I just said, do we know it's only Clifford?
It's not fully obvious, but I think I can prove it.
It's hard. It'd be hard to imagine how it, something else. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, anyway, that's an answerable question. One should be able to
answer
that. Yeah. Yeah.
So has anybody looked numerically for some of the higher dimensions?
Oh, not that I know of. I mean, Robin, you may know more about this. Has anyone looked numerically? Look numerically for seeks with this kind of symmetry, with this kind of tensor product symmetry group.
We looked at a number of groups, the nice error bases from Pfaffenacker and Rundler's online catalog.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them didn't work, but we found a couple of weird ones in dimension 6 and dimension 9.
Mm-hmm.
They did not include the abelian groups, so the only group that exists in every dimension is the Weyl-Heisenberg. But in power dimensions, you also have the tensor product. Like for two qubits, you have the tensor product of Weil-Heisenberg on each, right? And that's your symmetry group here. So the Weil-Heisenberg group for D equals 2 is the Pauli group. And so there's a difference between the standard Weil-Heisenberg group for 2 to the n and the nth product of the D equals 2 Weil-Heisenberg group. I don't think we actually looked at that.
It wouldn't.
Didn't
you look at the product?
Yeah.
Well, for actually, I mean, for like D equals 6, the regular mod 6 is the same as the product of the mod 2.
Oh,
and 3.
Right.
And in general, if you have, you know, product of primes.
The group is the same.
Yeah. Because.
Okay, right, yes, right,
yeah.
Got it, yes, indeed. I see, so that those are then examples.
Yeah, kind of degenerate.
Right, in a degenerate way, right.
So groups are different than members of asterisks.
Sorry.
But
does it
factor? 2 and 3 are relatively prime.
Yeah.
So if you take the generator of the mod 2 times the generator of mod 3, it doesn't get back to itself until you get 6 times.
Right.
Right. So if you have any set of any product of primes, that'll work.
So distinct primes.
Distinct primes.
So I guess then for all the composite numbers we do know,
that's
where numerics are used. For 6 and 15.
Yes, the square frequency.
Right, oh, I see.
So that suggests you will find them in all these?
It means you have to look at the right decomposition. Probably.
You have to look at the right decomposition. Yeah. So if you have a qubit and a qutrit, you can find a way of doing this that respects the part of those subsystems.
I mean,
way
interesting cases there are then the ones where there is a tensor product group that's not the same as the global Weil-Heisenberg group. They're just the same group. And that square
root.
Right. Well, but it's interesting with respect to whether you can have this composite structure or not.
Yeah, so sorry, say it again, Howard.
It seems to be interesting with respect to whether you can have this composite structure or not.
Yeah.
That you can.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the thing is that seeks normally it's about the whole thing. It's just something that characterizes the whole dimension, whole space. We don't normally think of seeks as being associated with the subsystems.
Yeah.
So what exactly is the claim here? Let's say dimension is 6. What can be done in dimension 6?
That you can factor the space. I think this is the claim. You can factor the space.
You can factor the file as per.
Yeah, you can
always factor the space.
Yeah, exactly. But of course you can factor the space. But you can choose Well, maybe I shouldn't say it that way. If you choose the right.
So what can we do now? We can take a fiducial from the qubit. A fiducial state of the qubit.
No, that's not the case.
But do you have to choose the right factorization of the six-dimensional space? You have to say, this is what we mean by the qubit, this is what we mean
once you fix the poly groups that you're using, then you have to use the right factorization. The qubit and qutrit correspondence with it.
Once you pick the Pauli, write down the Pauli group, the Weil-Heisenberg group for D equals 6.
Mm-hmm.
It factors.
Yeah.
It factors into a tensor product of the Pauli group and the D equals 3 Weil-Heisenberg group.
Okay.
Therefore, since you construct a seek, a Weil-Heisenberg seek, that has the symmetry of the six-dimensional Weil-Heisenberg group, since that group factors, your seek has a factor structure. Its group symmetry has a factor structure. It's not that it consists of tensor product states. It can't.
No, it certainly wouldn't consist of tensor product states. And of course, the one I showed doesn't consist of tensor
product. Maybe one of the questions is, does a fiducial now, so the symmetry factors, but can a fiducial be being constructed in some kind of simple way analogous to Bill's method where.
So it's not even clear how.
It'd be so special.
The method is not a tensor product potential, right?
Yeah,
it's a sum of two.
Yeah. So it'd be very interesting to see what these things look like, right? If you think about it as a. I mean, you write it in a. As think about it as a qubit and a qutrip, then what does it look like?
Well, I guess the simplest generalization.
Now, before we get carried away, we better make sure that actually I'm right. Certainly, Z2 times Z3 is equal to Z6.
Yeah.
If you mod out the faces, then it's just trivially true. Yeah. But it's possible there's something we're going to fit. I don't think so. I think it's just fine.
Well, that'd be kind of interesting. Because then you really could. I mean, for any case where you had distinct primes,
yeah,
you could use a seek that actually has the prime.
Which may be the right question to ask, following where I think you're going is, can you find a fiducial for D equals 6 that, when written in a tensor product basis, has a small number of terms?
Yeah,
it's trivial if it has 6 terms,
yeah.
But in Bill's case, it could have had 8.
Right, that's true.
I guess another thing that follows from this is if we've proven the existence of a seek in one prime dimension and another prime dimension, is it the sort of things that you guys are saying automatically imply the existence of a seek in the product?
Well, not based on what we know so far, but if you can figure out some general construction of neutral vectors.
Right, this is not for constructing seeks.
Yeah,
If you have one
on the product space,
yeah. Then you can think of it as in this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions?
If I can throw in a quick comment,
sure.
You have a slide sort of analogous to Chris's where you have the two paths.
Yes.
That result, the fact that you have this form of Born's rule. There's a very easy way, I think, to derive that or see that, which is that your... Can you pull up that?
Oh, sure, absolutely. This is the analogous one.
Right. If you can really think of these two paths as being physical operations,
mm-hmm.
where the blue horizontal line is the do-nothing operation.
Yes, right.
And the going that way line is a measure-re-prepare channel. Where you have a POVM, rank one POVM, and you make that measurement, and then you prepare the thing that you measure.
Yes.
And then it's very easy to show that any two design, if used as a POVM, is the depolarizing channel that annihilates your state and replaces it with the maximally mixed one with probability d over d plus 1. If it shrinks you to a factor 1 over d plus 1 of your original radius in the generalized block sphere. And that's where this formula comes from. What you're doing is you're just reinflating the block sphere, the generalized block sphere, by a factor of d plus 1.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's
a tensor product reinflation.
Okay.
That's certainly true. So if you take the tensor product of more than one seek, you're always going to get basically a big depolarizing
channel. Well, this actually is a tensor product of two depolarizing channels. One on each subsystem, which is not an overall.
Which is not, that's right, that's right.
And that's why the formula is more complicated.
Did you try working it out for three systems? Do you get some simple composition rule like you?
No, I didn't, but surely you can do it iteratively.
Yeah. Right, because your dimensions are arbitrary. You can
mm-hmm. Right. Right, so just take on the right.
I mean, what Robin is saying is true. Right? The reason I keep fixating on the seeks is because the dimensionality, the number of outcomes is right. So that the state space is of the same dimensionality of the simplex that you generate. If you used an arbitrary two design, you'd have a big simplex, and the allowed state space would be some small subspace.
Right.
There's something slightly wrong in the last thing I said about products, depolarizing and channels. Take that for granted. There's a small bug in that.
Okay.
Well, no, if the product of the of two designs is a two design, then again, it's depolarizing.
But the product of two designs is not a two design. Otherwise, the product of two seeks would be a seek.
No, not necessarily. Oh, well, yeah, yeah, it would be. Yeah, yeah, okay,
so
yeah,
that, the product of two depolarizing channels
yeah.
is a depolarizing channel. But in this case, the channel is not actually the product. The composite channel is not the product of the individual channels. It's a little bit different. That's the little bug.
Oh, yeah, the same.
So this, if you could do this in general, so you could always...
If you could always do this.
Then you don't way of generating this. Of the atoms for composite numbers.
Well, that's one thing.
Could you imagine doing it for non-composite numbers? Or so, for example, you might take three qubits, you got eight dimensions, but then, like, look at, say a five-dimensional subspace of that. Okay, and could you imagine somehow generating the, just trying to get a CP of the M for that five-dimensional subspace.
Can you go down?
Yeah, using this kind of technique, is this
Oh, I see.
So we only want to generate now five squared operators.
And you have something for six dimensions?
And you have something actually for eight.
Or I'll say for eight.
So you have eight dimensions, but you want to find some fiducial state, some set of generators, and generate just five of them that happen to be a PVM, PVM on a five dimensional subspace.
I doubt it. Just because the angle's not the same. That is, the angle between two vectors. Oh, I see. You're cutting off some of the components.
That's right. Yeah, you're cutting off. Yeah, you're
projecting down.
Project down. Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah.
So sort of below and then project. I mean, because people often use that trick. So, you know, you want to model sort of you know, prime dimensional space. You just sort of take two power n and then cut down to.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Right. But with I haven't been working with these things for long enough to really have good intuition. I guess it's going to go wrong.
It doesn't even work at this stage. Obviously work for even for the composite.
Well, right, you don't need to get it right. I was hoping that because there are an infinite number of fiducial vectors for dimension 3, that maybe something like this would work for 3 times 3, and then would also work for 3 times 3 times 3. And 3 times 3 times 3 times 3, and thereby generate an infinite number of dimensions, so generate seeks for infinite, which we do not have, right? We have no method of generating, there's no infinite family of dimensions for which we have to seek. No way of doing that.
Lee Houston was here a year or so ago and gotten to the D equals 3 seek problem and did just amazing, incomprehensible things. With it. I mean, he pulled content out of that problem, but I don't think anybody else understood what the hell he was doing. It would be interesting to bounce your intuitions off of his intuitions and see if they make a baby.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, so we're done.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.